Bulkley, Hunt, Willard, Hosner, Merriam, Flint, possessed the land, which rendered to their toil hay, corn, roots, hemp, flax, apples, wool, and wood. Each of these landlords walked amidst his farm, saying, "'Tis mine, my children's, and my name's. How sweet the west wind sounds in my own trees. How graceful climb those shadows on my hill. I fancy these pure waters and the flags know me, as does my dog. We sympathize, and I affirm my actions smack of the soil. Where are these men? Asleep beneath their grounds, and strangers fond as they, their furrows plow." In 1846, when Ralph Waldo Emerson suggested that the land owns its inhabitants and not the other way around, most of the remaining American wilderness was about to be transformed into cropland, pastures, and timber. The consumption of the wilderness built a strong and prosperous nation. But what is the role of wilderness in America today? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What's the relationship between private landowners and proponents of wilderness preservation? What are the risks involved with increased agricultural industrialization? And what is the value of ecological restoration? Our guest is Kurt Meine, senior fellow at the Aldo Leopold Foundation, author of Aldo Leopold, His Life and Work, which was recently republished by the UW Press, and he's also a professor at the UW-Madison.
Welcome back to University of the Year.
It's good to be back with you.
Let's start with Aldo Leopold, since that's your main interest. What key role would you say he played in the whole concept of the wilderness and what we should do about it?
Well, Emily, he was certainly one of the key figures in 20th century advocacy for protecting wilderness. And so throughout his life, beginning very early in his career in the U.S. Forest Service in the American Southwest, but right up to his last days here in Wisconsin in 1948, he was a lifelong advocate for protecting the best of our remaining wild spaces. Yet at the same time, through that long arc of his career in advocacy, his very idea of wilderness shifted and changed, and his sense of the values of wilderness evolved over that whole period, so that he began to connect it not just to our deep concern for wild places, but to the rest of the landscape, the more inhabited parts of the landscape, even to the cities. So it's that breadth and the interconnectivity of his vision for land with wilderness still within it, but also the rest of the landscape that really sets him apart from all the other great thinkers and advocates for wilderness.
And as we get toward Earth Day in a couple of weeks, of course, we're thinking about Aldo Leopold and the issues that he faced back in the 30s and the issues that he forecast for our generation. But difficult assignment to balance this natural biodiversity, which seems to be all the desire today, with the increasing land use, which seems inevitable.
Well, we have, especially in the last couple decades, really begun to understand that putting a line on the map around something or a fence around it or any kind of boundary line, if you're a conservationist, it doesn't work. That you don't protect a place simply by setting it apart from people. That, in fact, all parts of the landscape are in constant change, and we, our human community, is also in constant change. And so we have a much more dynamic view of how land changes. And the fact that wilderness, as we classically have defined it, is not a static thing. It's constantly evolving itself in response to forces within what we protect and forces beyond the boundary line that we put on a map, perhaps.
One of the things that Leopold seems so ahead of his time in identifying is the way that all the different parts of what we would call an ecosystem work together, whether it's the soil, the birds, the animals, the trees, you know, everything, not just sort of taking a look at an endangered animal and thinking you can discuss just that.
Exactly. And that was his personality and his way his mind worked, but it was also the way that through his career he learned the way that as conservationists we need to think about the way the world works. You can't separate out any part of it, as John Muir famously said. And Leopold comes along with a more scientific, ecological perspective on that dynamic landscape and begins to understand that as much as he was devoted to the protection of wilderness, you can't save that unless you also are conserving the rest of the landscape. And so he explores those connections, whether it's, how species cross boundary lines, water crosses boundary lines, how we in our consumption of food and other material things in the world, how we have to understand the sources of our consumption. And so increasingly through his life, he began to emphasize these dynamic qualities and these interconnections.
Well, if we were to take a place like, Yellowstone, and look at how that would stand up according to the principles of Aldo Leopold, how would you go about introducing species to create the needed biodiversity on the one hand, but not totally get things out of whack on the other? I mean, how do you restore or even manage something that's even remotely wilderness?
It's a great example. Yellowstone, since its beginning as the first national park in the world in 1872, has been a great laboratory for this. So one way you begin is by noting that before it was set up as a, quote, protected wilderness, there were people there. And there were processes there that, since time immemorial, had shaped the landscape, and the landscape shaped the people. When we come along with a different idea that setting it apart as a park, we had to learn some lessons, and we did, in fact, learn them over 100 years, 100 more than that now. And just to choose a couple examples, in 1988, the great fires swept over Yellowstone, and this was a shock to a lot of people. And there was a lot of what to some was destruction, but to others was regeneration, a renewal.
So the ideas, I mean, if I remember this correctly, I went through there in 1990 and saw a lot of the effects of that fire. Of course, went on for quite a long way. It seems to me when you use the word shock, the shock for a lot of people was that the fire wasn't put out.
Exactly. A new way of approaching these questions had already come in and been around for more than a decade among resource managers, wilderness managers, that in fact in some places, at least in some places, not everywhere, but we had the ability to sit back and let nature, quote, take its course, although that comes with certain complexities itself. But the idea there was this forest was going to burn anyway, and that if we were to allow a more natural fire regime, as we say in the business, to take hold on the land, that in fact it would be healthier in the long run. Now, this was a brand new idea for a lot of people, especially for the general public, but the science was well established. We had learned so much in the prior couple decades about how fire behaves on the landscape. And so the decisions were made, in fact, to the extent possible, let it burn. But in the years to follow, I was there actually in the spring, almost on opening day the following spring, I remember coming into this charred, blackened landscape, but seeing those sprouts coming up through the snow, and that sense of regeneration had already taken hold. And the experiment continues. We have continued to monitor the recovery of that forest, but in the meantime, another laboratory experiment, if you will, at Yellowstone was the reintroduction of wolves there in the mid-1990s, which brought a whole other dimension of the processes on the land into play there as wolves, the top predator in that system, came back into the landscape and began to reshape that plant and animal community with the people there observing it and in fact, being drawn to that as one of the great spectacles now of Yellowstone.
And there's an irony always when you have crowds of tourists going to see wilderness, because by definition it becomes not wilderness when you've got all those crowds there.
You have the question of accessibility,
right,
too.
And how do you define, or how would Leopold have defined wilderness? I always think of it as the place we're not, and that we've never been.
Well, that's a great question. He defined and redefined wilderness many times through his career. He began with a very basic notion. It was a recreational definition. He defined it because he was interested at that point in hunting. He was himself a hunter and wanted, along with his colleagues, places where you could go and experience hunting in a large area. So he defined it as a place where you could go on a pack trip for 2 weeks and not cross your own trail. It was a very recreational definition. But by the end of his life, he'd gone through a whole set of values. He began to understand it wasn't just about recreation. It was about our sense of history, of where our modern civilization comes from. It was about respect for other cultures and how they inhabited landscapes before Euro-Americans arrived. It was about the values that come with understanding the broader importance of wilderness to our sense of place in a landscape. And by the late 1930s, as an ecologist, a mature ecologist, he began to understand wilderness as, he put it, a land laboratory, a place where ecological processes played out in the absence of strong human influence. There's always a degree of human influence, but he began to value wilderness as a place where he could understand how fire worked in a landscape, what role large predators had, the diversity and functioning of those systems. So it's a very different definition, much more biological, ecological, cultural definition by
less,
the end of his life.
Less human-centric.
Exactly, and less about me and my desire to go hunting, although that was still a part of it, but now embedding it within this much more expansive and deeper appreciation of the place itself.
Well, to maintain a wilderness, then, it seems to me you have to make some judgment calls. For example, if the Yellowstone fire had been caused by a careless camper, would it have been put out as opposed to if it had been caused by lightning?
Great example of the paradox that comes with not just protecting wilderness, but sustaining the health of more wild parts of our landscape, to rephrase it a little bit. And so we did have to rethink, yeah, the role of people, whether they're there as visitors or whether they live in the landscape, and all the entirety of the plant and animal community that coexists with you. And that includes now not just wilderness, but you begin to see wilderness embedded within a larger, more humanized landscape.
In one of his essays, I think Aldo Leopold says we need to think like a mountain. Can you explain what he means by that? Think like a mountain.
It's one of his most famous and most resonant phrases, and there's a lot to it. He's talking about scales. He's talking about scales of time and space. To me, that's what I hear in that phrase. He's saying we can't just think about our own self-interests in a given place, that the mountain is something larger and older than us. So in space, we have to think much more broadly than our own immediate environment and the things we care about within it, and look at the entirety of the landscape before you, and to see the entirety of the plant and animal community, the soils and waters, what he called the land. But there's also a deep time scale going on there. In that particular essay, Thinking Like a Mountain, he really refers to the deep evolutionary history of the place and the deep ecological reality of it, so that we don't now just think of that mountain with its grizzly bear on top of it or its wolf as those are potential threats to my self-interest. We begin to see this is a place that has its own rhythms of time and change, that if we are wise, we will at least begin to think of ourselves existing within. So it's a profound reorientation of the way we normally see the world as us at the center and the world revolving around us, and only our time and place is important, to seeing the world as having a larger reality, and we exist within it, and we can choose how we decide to live within it.
We take up a lot of space, though, and a lot of it is already urbanized. And did Aldo Leopold have a sense of what role the wilderness could play in a city?
Mm. Well, he sure did. He's so associated with wild places because he was so profoundly committed to protecting them. But in reality, he was also quite an urban creature himself. He grew up in town in Iowa. He attended college in New Haven, Connecticut. He actually lived in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and was head of their Chamber of Commerce at one point, amazingly enough. And then here in Madison, in Wisconsin, he was living and working in Madison. And so for those of you who live or visit Madison, you know about our wonderful University of Wisconsin Arboretum right here in town. And so in the very midst of the urban setting of Madison, just to choose one example, he's saying we need to be understanding our connection to land, even in cities, and set up the Arboretum as a place to explore this brand new field of at the time of ecological restoration, to remind ourselves of our origins in the landscape and how that place could serve urban people and students in particular, to reconnect them to their own ecological past, if you will, but also to the future. He understood that that was important to where we're going. If we lose our connection with land, we could find ourselves going astray. So he was very definitely committed to thinking of conservation across the landscape, all the way from the most wild places to the most urban. He had a line once where he said, "The weeds in a city lot convey the same ecological lessons as the redwood trees." If you have that eye of an ecologist, you can see in any place the pulses and rhythms of life and the diversity that's before you, and understand its history, and hence, hopefully, understand your own role in it a little more deeply.
What got him angry, and what did he see as sort of the enemies of what he envisioned as a place where wilderness would, as Thoreau had put it, be the preservation of the world?
Well, by the time he was a mature professor here in Madison, Leopold didn't get angry very often. He had learned how to deal with his own sense of loss, what he called the ecological conscience, this fact that if you're educated in this way, you live, as he put it, in a world of wounds. But what was the response to that? To get angry was not very productive. It was better to be engaged and try to make a positive difference. There were few things that would get his goat, if you will. He was impatient, let's say, with especially people in the public arena or in positions of influence in government or other walks of life who simply refused to deal with the reality of the world around them. But he was a teacher, and he understood that first and foremost he had to instruct and help inform. So he tempered his anger, if you will, with a real deep sense of obligation and responsibility to help his fellow citizens come to terms with this new way of looking at the world.
What about businesses?
Well, Leopold understood economic reality. Let's put it that way. He was the son of a successful businessman, a furniture maker in Iowa. He worked very closely with the business community through his life. He understood economic reality, but he also understood that the context of economic ideas was changing because of this new worldview. He once said, we fancy that industry supports us, forgetting what supports industry, that is, the land around us. Or in another quote from the early 30s, the dark years of the Dust Bowl, he said, the most fundamental kind of economic loss the human race can suffer is the destruction of soil. And that's not the way most economists even then were thinking, much less now. But he understood that unless we readjusted our economic worldview to match the reality of ecological change, that we were headed for trouble. And he saw it himself firsthand, and along with the rest of his generation, in the 1930s. And that's a lesson that's continued to resonate down to the present.
We'll look at the relationship between private landowners and conservationists when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. The thing to be prevented is destructive private land use of any and all kinds. The thing to be encouraged is the use of private land in such a way as to combine the public and private interest of the greatest possible degree. So wrote Aldo Leopold in 1934. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Kurt Meine, biographer of Aldo Leopold and also a mover and shaker in many environmental ways around Wisconsin and, in fact, nationally, too. Well, it's one thing to say that we would like to prevent this private land abuse, but it's another to actually go about doing it, isn't it, Kurt? How do you get a private landowner to, let's say, see the error of his ways?
Or shall we say the potential for positive opportunities, too? It's a question that Leopold wrestled with, especially after he came back to Wisconsin. He had worked out west. He was working on large expanses of public land, the national forest, and more on national wildlife refuges. But coming back to Wisconsin, you're coming back to a landscape dominated by private lands, farmers, and other private landowners who were actually in a point of crisis in many areas. It was, again, a time of really difficult environmental conditions with massive soil erosion, water pollution, loss of wildlife species. So Leopold wasn't alone. He was part of a generation and a place here in Wisconsin where they were really struggling with how to work with the farmer. And the farmer was looking for help back then, many of them. And so they began to ask that question, how do you provide new incentives and new directions for private landowners? So he worked through a series of potential solutions to that problem. For example, specifically, he went into wildlife management because he was hoping that farmers, by being able to manage their farms in ways that would encourage wildlife, could actually come up with a new crop, as he was thinking originally, that by raising wildlife, then hunting opportunities would arise and might be people willing to help support that. So he experimented with that. But then there were the hard cases where terrible soil erosion had really wrecked whole landscapes and watersheds. And there you needed a different solution. You needed communities of farmers and other landowners to come together. And they began experimenting with that here in Wisconsin in a place out there just south of La Crosse called Coon Valley, the first watershed demonstration project in the nation. And the whole secret to that was to bring together experts in forestry and wildlife and agriculture in order to work together, as you had to solve problems at that scale. Then began a series of programs at the national and state level. The Soil Conservation Service was created to assist private landowners. That was their sole mission. Unlike other agencies like the Park Service or Forest Service that we're familiar with, the Soil Conservation Service, now known as the Natural Resources Conservation Service, didn't own land. They were an agency dedicated to working with private landowners.
And were there incentives offered to private landowners to help them?
Indeed, there were. They worked especially through the university and the extension system to provide materials, to provide labor through the young Civilian Conservation Corps workers of the day, but mostly to provide information. Farmers were needing this kind of new information in order to reform their own practices and experiment in new ways.
And what could you do, if anything, once the topsoil had gone? We've seen these films from the 30s of the soil just blowing away.
Right. Well, they developed and experimented. I mean, they were really experimenting with a lot of different techniques. In the hill countries of western Wisconsin, you can still go through, especially our driftless area of western Wisconsin, and see the contour strips and contour cropping going on the hillsides. You can see the grassy waterways where the little valleys are, and the terraces that were in place to hold back the soil and the water. The whole idea was to keep at least the soil you had in place and to slow down the water. And so these were experimental days. They didn't quite know what would work. But now you can see three generations later, still see those techniques in place on the ground. But Leopold noticed that something was missing, that after this initial flush of activity, that a lot of farmers were abandoning some of these because they would keep the ones that would make them money and provide a little bit of a profit, but sometimes let go of the ones that were a little less returning of money in the short run. And so he began to think much more about the ethical dimensions of this. It wasn't just the economic incentives you needed. You had to have, beneath all those other techniques, a basic social compact with the land. You had to get people to think of themselves as part of a larger community that did include, as he put it, soils, waters, plants, and animals.
So he's, as it were, progressing beyond the progressive notion at this point, which would have emphasized this efficiency, the return that you would get from your investment in the land, and he's thinking in a more absolute terms when you talk about ethics.
That's exactly right. He was a child of the progressive conservation movement, but he was himself pushing beyond that to say it's more than just an economic relationship to land, even a sustainable economic relationship, that it's also about our own communities, our cultures, our identities, and the things we care about. And so he began to devote himself much more to this discussion of the cultural dimensions of conservation. And it's worth mentioning that the University of Wisconsin here in Madison played such an important role in this. The College of Agriculture here during those years, the 1930s in particular, was devoted to the cultural dimensions of rural development, not just the economic and technological changes, but to really working across the disciplines to bring the arts, to bring the humanities into farm communities and to draw on that rich cultural tradition that comes off the farm, too. It's something that really distinguished Wisconsin in those days, and to some degree I think we still have that.
With the idea being that the arts and the humanities would help people understand the spiritual value of nature in part, or that, I mean, what was the link for Leopold between...
Well, the phrase you often saw in those years, and Leopold used variations on it, was the quality of rural life. Knowing that we were going through a lot of difficult times in our urban areas, but even more so in perhaps in our rural areas, and that in order to sustain rural communities and culture and economies, we needed to think, how do we enrich not just the farmer's, you know, bank book, but how do we enrich the life of our rural communities and how do we sustain that? And so the College of Agriculture was very devoted to that mission. It brought in the first artist in residence in a college anywhere here at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Leopold was part of that movement here in Madison that would eventually express itself in his own writing. In fact, when you read many of the essays in his classic work, A Sand County Almanac, they were first written for farmers, helping them to understand their own landscape, the plants and animals that were in their own back 40, and how the farmer could become a steward of those resources as well as the more typical commodities.
Did he work with religious leaders and religions as well in order to try to get away from the sort of you own the land approach, you have dominion over the land?
You know, Leopold himself always had an affinity and interest in those questions of the religious dimensions of conservation, or spiritual dimensions, if you will. And from an early age, one of his first published articles, he went back to the Bible and he read the prophets. And he wrote an article called The Forestry of the Prophets, in which he cited passages from the Old Testament about forestry practices in the various books of the Old Testament. But up until the very end of his life, he was in discussion with colleagues here in Madison on faculty as well as friends around the country that were really trying to open up this conversation to say that our even as we had to examine our economic systems, we had to examine our own ethical and cultural and spiritual traditions to see what they could offer to this conversation. What could they bring to this definition of a land ethic, as he would ultimately call it? And indeed, he did draw upon especially some good colleagues here in Madison in the Department of Philosophy and other academic colleagues here in Madison.
Did he at all get into what is now known as organic farming and organic crops?
He was very deeply interested in what ecology could do, what ecology had to say about the way we practiced agriculture. What we now call organic agriculture or farming was just beginning to become a concept at that point, defined by a few key books in the 1920s and 30s. Leopold was aware of those, but he had a little different take on it as an ecologist. He was looking at the same places, but with a little different eye. But the really important moment for him comes in those few years he would have remaining after World War II, when the new chemicals, synthetic chemicals developed during the war years, were beginning to be applied to our agricultural landscapes for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, because this is 20 years before DDT, for example, had its cover blown by Rachel
right.
Carson and others.
But you can find an article in 1946 where Leopold criticizes the indiscriminate use of DDT, and he was beginning to worry about it. He wasn't alone. Again, leading ecologists and other scientists were concerned about these new industrial chemicals coming into the landscape. So he begins to write about where we're going. Where are we going in our agricultural landscapes? And he, in 1946, publishes an article in which he distinguishes between, as he put it, the farm as a factory and the farm as a place to live. And if you think about it, Wisconsin was a particularly rich place to consider that what would become the leading kind of dichotomy in the rest of the century.
Yes, plenty of both kinds.
And where the trends would go, we've held on to a lot of our smaller scale farms in Wisconsin because we have dairy and we have a different type of landscape than, say, Illinois or Iowa. And so he was deeply concerned about trends in agriculture. As he put it, you know, he's concerned partly because of the wildlife consequences for wildlife of the changing farm landscape. But he understands that ultimately, for most people, wildlife isn't going to be what determines these decisions. He says, in the long run, it's going to be bad for wildlife, but it's going to be bad for people, too. If we follow this path to thinking of our farms as purely factories to produce things for us. But again, he was always balancing economic need and ecological reality. So he understood the need to keep farms viable and economically healthy, but he also understood if you don't have an ecologically healthy farm, you're going to suffer.
Did he discourage the growing of certain crops? I mean, tobacco, I think, has a which has, I guess, traditionally been a pretty good crop in Wisconsin, has this reputation for being particularly hard on soil and I assume there are some other crops that have since become less popular in Wisconsin because of that damage. And then, of course, you have to change the economy somehow to create a demand for the replacement crop, too. Mm.
I would say he didn't express concern so much about a type of crop as he did about the increasing intensification of all crops. This begins in the 1920s in his own writing. This is the period when farm machinery comes onto the landscape for the first time. Internal combustion engines in the form of tractors and other farm implements come onto the landscape. What does that mean? It means your fields get larger. It means those fence rows and tree lines between fields disappear, and with them disappear even smaller species of wildlife. And this becomes his really deep concern through the 1920s and 30s. And so what he's not concerned so much about which crop where, but he is interested in the configuration of a typical farm in Wisconsin or the Midwest, let's say, and how that changing pressures and opportunities in farming would affect the wildlife community and ultimately the human community as well.
Did he ever venture into politics in terms of how the government should handle regulations?
Did he testify before Congress?
Well, he was a public figure from very early in his career. He never shied away from being involved in the public arena and understood that that was part of, in his view anyway, part of his own responsibility as a conservationist, as a citizen, as a scientist, was to bring his expertise and experience. So even in his earlier career in the Southwest, he was actively involved in formation of policy and very strongly an advocate for certain positions. When he comes to Wisconsin, he's immediately adopted by the conservation leadership of that day, which was in a group called the Isaac Walton League, still around, as a leader in state policymaking. He helped reform Wisconsin's conservation establishment in the late 1920s. And all through the 1930s and up and really until the end of his life, he would become deeply enmeshed in conservation policy. By the end of his life, he was serving on the State Conservation Commission, the board that oversaw what is now the Department of Natural Resources, and was particularly embroiled in our perennial debates over how to manage our deer population.
Always.
So he was already at that point wrapped up in some of the things that still concern us today.
Well, and so where did he land on this at the end of his life in 1948? Was he advocating a deer-wolf relationship?
Well, he'd gone through lots of trials and tribulations by that time. He was advocating basically for land health, let me put it that way. By that time, he had matured in his own thinking as a conservation scientist, as a practitioner, and even as a hunter himself, to thinking that we can't be concerned, it goes back to where we started this conversation, with this or that part of the land. If you're a conservationist only concerned with soil or water or wildlife or a particular species of wildlife, you're going to miss something. And he had adopted this much more holistic and integrated view that said, if your deer herd is not in proper relationship with the vegetation that supports it, that you're going to be in trouble. He learned this lesson, and others had. So he was advocating for keeping the deer herd in check as it was burgeoning at that point in the absence of natural predators, and trying to adjust hunting policy to facilitate that healthy level of deer populations. And so he was, at that point, an advocate for removing bounties on wolves, allowing wolves, which at that point were almost gone from Wisconsin, to allow them to come back and do, as he called it, the fine-tuning of the deer population. We have a much more advanced scientific understanding of this now, even as our wolf population has recovered dramatically and our deer population as well. But those same fundamental issues of the relationship between people, predators, prey, and the land are still the things that we have to wrestle with.
In the film that you've worked on about Aldo Leopold, you spend some time on the turning point moment that had to do with looking in a wolf's eyes.
Right. It's an incident that occurred very early in his career, within the first few weeks of his first job in the U.S. Forest Service, when he and one of his crew were out one day and did, in fact, come across a pack of wolves and began, as he said, pumping lead into it. And he ended up killing two wolves, including the mother wolf of the pack, and seeing, as he said, the fierce green fire in its eyes dying. That incident lodged in his mind, in his mind's eye, but it would take him 35 years before he really came to terms with what it meant, that what it meant scientifically, what it meant in terms of his work as a conservationist, and what it meant to him spiritually and psychically. So finally, many years later, in 1944, he writes at the urging of one of his own graduate students, this essay called Thinking Like a Mountain, in which he really examined his own role in this and examined what the meaning of that was for the larger conservation mission that he had taken on in his life. And as he put it, he began to see something different in those eyes, something known only to the mountain and the wolf. And now he began to understand it. And it was essentially this understanding that we are part of processes that are much bigger than us, and larger than us, longer term than us. And how do we act within that? That's what the science of ecology revealed to the world and to him. But now it had these, what he began to think more and more of as ethical lessons. When you have that perspective and that lens that you see the world through, suddenly your own complex role within the world and within your place changes. That was the lesson that he learned that early day in 1909, but it would again take him so much life experience to come to that final conclusion.
We'll come to some final conclusions about Aldo Leopold, about Earth Day, and about our relationship with the environment in the 21st century when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
We abuse land because we regard it as a commodity belonging to us. When we see land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect. Those are the words of Aldo Leopold in the Sand County Almanac. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Kurt Meine, and we are talking about Aldo Leopold, Earth Day, wilderness, and the conservation movement. And let's start with that idea of community-based conservation. Is that something, then, that Aldo Leopold had specific ideas for how to bring about?
He had ideas, and he had ways of experimenting that were right here in Wisconsin and that have now expanded well beyond our borders. Put it in context. He was trained at Yale. He was working for the federal government on national forests out west. But he began to realize that that approach to conservation, necessary as it was and useful as it was in many places, wouldn't suffice in every place. So especially after moving back to the Wisconsin of the 1920s and 30s, he began to see a way for the need for a different approach, the need to not just do what we would now call perhaps top-down conservation, but that it had to bubble up from below, that it had to be part of our own relationships in the places we live. So earlier in the hour, we talked about Coon Valley, this watershed out on the Mississippi River where more than 300 or 400 farmers came together as a community, if you will, to heal a degraded watershed and landscape. he began to apply that same thinking to other situations of getting farmers to work together to improve wildlife habitat. Tried that in several places here in southern Wisconsin. He began to see that entire watersheds, river systems, even migration routes, that if you wanted, for example, to protect a migratory bird species, you couldn't do it in just one place. You had to create a community connection across that migration route, just to choose another example. And so this lays the foundation for what in the last 20 years has become a really important trend in conservation, again, away from thinking that governments at any level can solve all these problems. That as necessary as government involvement may be, we also had to come together as communities in all our different places to find new ways of relating to one another, to the land, and to bring these solutions from the bottom up and not just the top down.
What did he learn about the resilience of the environment, though? You know, it's gone through so much, and it looks so devastated. What about the ability of the environment to bounce back?
Well, you know, we have long heard the phrase, the fragile ecosystems that we exist within, and they are fragile to some degree, but they are also resilient. And so we have this paradox. Landscapes are always changing, and they are both fragile and resilient. And now we've begun to think about this in a much more precise and even scientific way, but think of yourself in Wisconsin in the 1930s. The North Country is cut over pretty much, first the pines and then the hardwoods. The prairies and savannas of the South are dramatically changed by agriculture. Wildlife populations are perhaps at their lowest point in our history. Waterways are degraded and polluted, drained and dredged across the Midwest. So it's a very troubling time with the Dust Bowl coming on and droughts. So as sometimes we think of our own times as the worst hard times of modern environmental concerns, but put yourself back in that period and you can see what Leopold and his generation were facing. And so they began to again experiment and understand, see how they could, in fact, increase the capacity of the land to be resilient, to return to some state of ecological health. And Leopold himself, of course, is personally working on this on his own farm, worn-out, wasted land along the Wisconsin River near Baraboo. But he's working with landowners all across the state, as are many others. And this helps us understand why that little experiment they tried here in Madison at the Arboretum is so important, bringing prairies and savannas and wetlands back to a small place here on the edge of Madison's downtown area as an experiment to see how could we work with the native plants and animals to bring back their ecological processes and, again, what he would ultimately come to call land health, which he defined very specifically was, as he put it, the capacity for self-renewal in the soils, waters, plants, and animals, or collectively, the land.
Was he aware also then of the effect of straightening out, say, a creek, like Pheasant Branch Creek, for example, the effect that that would have on biodiversity and water quality?
He certainly was. In fact, very, very to the point. He knew this from his own experience here in the Midwest. He grew up on the Mississippi River. He saw this as a boy already, this mania to straighten every stream, which, of course, their natural meanders and their natural processes of flooding and how our desire to control everything was really ruining these systems. And so probably the ultimate example is when he traveled to Germany in 1935, and he described, as he called, these rivers confined to their straight jackets of masonry, is how he phrased it. And coming home to Wisconsin and to America, he began to say, you know, maybe we shouldn't go down that road. He began to understand, and again, with many of his colleagues at the time, to think of rivers as dynamic systems, as systems with their own processes that maintained their capacity for self-renewal.
And maybe that there was something valuable in the wild way that they meandered. He seems conscious throughout Sand County Almanac that he's in a minority and that there are going to be a lot of people who don't feel what he feels for nature. He writes, for example, there are some who can live without wild things and some who cannot. For us of the minority, the opportunity to see geese is more important than television, and the chance to find a passflower is a right inalienable as free speech. just sense in that that, I mean, I would have thought that it would feel a majority understood the value of wild things and geese and so on, but he must have felt it was a bit of a losing battle.
Well, he certainly felt himself as part of a changing culture that was losing its connections to the land. And even in agriculture, farmers, as they became more mechanized, were in a sense becoming more removed from the land. And of course, he understood the need for greater efficiency and that change would come. But as we became more of an urban nation and more of an industrial nation, he did sense that we were moving away from these connections that were taken for granted just even a few short years and decades before. And after World War II, he lived only a few more years, but you could see this ramping up of technological change and economic growth that would happen in those first few post-war years. That's when he's completing his manuscript for what would become a Sand County Almanac, and that passage that you've just cited was in fact written just in 1947, when he was really thinking about what was happening to the world. How did this global cataclysm of world war change our relationships in the human community? But think of all the new technologies that would be unleashed by the experience of war, everything from the atom bomb to synthetic compounds on the farm to the ramping up of the automobile culture, all the changes that would come to the American landscape. He began to see that the science of ecology didn't have so much to offer to understanding these changes and was necessary. So even though he did sense himself a minority, he also had a deep sense of responsibility, that he, as one who had absorbed this new way of seeing the world, was obligated to teach and to write and to share his ideas in the hopes that it would help people think through their own places and their own challenges in new and hopefully more enduring ways.
Did he ever target children, you know, in terms of bringing school children into a new awareness while he still had a chance to kind of influence their way of thinking?
He did. In fact, Wisconsin in 1935 passed a law mandating conservation education. It was one of the first states in the country to do this. And Leopold knew very well a lot of the individuals who were involved in that movement and was in touch with them, corresponding with them, meeting with them, and understood very deeply that the next generation coming out of this really trauma of the Dust Bowl years had to be equipped. And many of his own students here would go on to be teachers, and he was constantly advising teachers around the state. His archives are full of letters from school teachers from small towns and cities across the state, on which they're asking for advice because there was really a dearth of materials, and Leopold was the go-to guy. He was the one that teachers would write to and ask, do you have anything that I can use in the classroom to meet this new educational mandate, but also to re-engage my students? So he was, in fact, very dedicated to the mission of conservation education.
What did he actually do on his farm? Mm. How would you be able to tell that is a farm that has the guidance of Aldo Leopold?
He and his family, because this was a family project, he, his wife, and their five kids, and their dog, or dogs as they would come through the years, they were all involved in this project, and it really began from scratch. This was a landscape that had been overused and really wasn't suited for farm, very sandy soil along the Wisconsin River bottoms, and so it was barren. And their first priority really was to just stabilize the soils. This was the priority all across the Midwest. So they planted pines. That was one of their main activities. Every spring break, they would go, just like this week of the year, the whole family would go up and plant 3,000 pines per year. But then they began to elaborate on that, bringing in native prairie plants, bringing in shrubs that wildlife would like and use, really trying to bring a vegetative cover back to the landscape, but using it as a laboratory for how do you spatially organize this? Where do you put the pines? Where do they fit? Asking these kind of more aesthetic questions even. So there wasn't just restoring the health, but also creating a more beautiful landscape. They explicitly, I think, thought of it in these terms. And so it was a series of projects over the years to keep the soil in place, to make sure the water worked on the land the way that would help to the healing process, if you will. What would bring the wildlife back? What were the species that different species, what were the plant species that different animal species would would appreciate having on the landscape. So it was always a new adventure every weekend, practically, when they were up there with the new technique to try on the land.
And they kept track of, they kept records, right, the phenology and so on, where they would document all the different species and seasonal occurrences?
They kept very detailed records. This is a hallmark of Leopold's life and work. He hardly ever did anything outside or on the land without measuring and keeping note of it, and that allows us now to look back to more than 70 years now to see the records of their own work and to understand how things have changed. It's one of the important legacies of Leopold and his family that by examining those records, we can understand, for example, the timing, how the timing has changed of the blooming of plants or the arrival of birds, and especially with climate change as a growing concern and a coming reality, they help us to calibrate that degree of change, and never more so than this early spring we've had this year.
There's a phrase that sometimes is associated with Aldo Leopold, that concept of environmental justice. What did that mean to him?
Oh, gosh. Well, he, you know, we have had a movement in the last 20 years around the concept of environmental justice, that the pressures on our environment affect not only the natural community, but our own human communities and different segments of it. So it brings into a whole new raft of concerns that early conservation has hardly dealt with. Leopold didn't explicitly address that concern. It's really only in the last 20 years, in fact, that we've begun to think about this more deeply. But he did have a key point to make on this. In an unpublished manuscript, he once wrote, "There are two things that interest me, the relation of people to each other and the relation of people to land." And in that simple sentence, you can see the breadth of his concern, his understanding of the intertwined fate of human communities and natural communities, that we had to address both if we were going to achieve conservation. So those human relationships, which they didn't focus as much on in their day, are something we're deeply now interested and concerned with, and that has brought entire new constituencies into the conservation and environmental arena. Communities of color and different diverse backgrounds are now part of the conversation in a way they never were in Leopold's day. And even though he didn't explicitly address this very much, he provided a little bit of the foundations on which we can now begin to think about those things more carefully.
What do you think? I know you don't like to say what Leopold would think, but what do you think he might say about Earth Day, other than that it should be every day?
Oh, well, that's a great question. I think he would certainly appreciate this movement, since I was a kid and experienced the first Earth Day as a young lad, to how far we've grown in bringing a global consciousness to the world. And in fact, you may argue well that it was part of his own legacy. Through Gaylord Nelson, our governor and senator here in Wisconsin, a direct line, and not just Gaylord, but others in the Wisconsin conservation community brought this idea to the world. But at the same time, I think Leopold might say, you know, it's not just about the earth as a whole. It's about your place, your specific spot on the earth that you really connect to. It's hard to connect to the whole earth for most of us. But through the place you are and the world that you exist in locally, that's where you can make the meaningful connection that will sustain your interest and your commitment perhaps in the longer run.
Our guest has been Kurt Meine, filling us in on some of the latest thinking in the legacy of Aldo Leopold and Earth Day. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Look forward to your next visit. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.